Historima. Listen to the extraordinary.
Ειρήνη Παπατσαρούχα, έτσι ξεκίνησε η ζωή μου και τελειώνει με το Ρίνιο Μίσιου, το όνομα του συζύγου μου, του Χρόνη Μίσιου.
Ειρήνη Παπατσαρούχα. That's how my life started and it ends with Ρίνιο Μίσιου, the surname of my husband, Χρόνης Μίσιος. In 67, the dictatorship came about. Both of us were members of the Lambrakis youth. Chronis was on the Central Council, an organizational secretary, and I was working on the magazine we published called Our Generation. That spring, we were preparing for the peace march and elections. The dictatorship broke. We were at home. We lived at 126 Ippokratou Street, and we had little Katerina with us, who was just 4 years old. We had her with us because my sister was pregnant and had a difficult pregnancy. So on the evening of Friday, April 21st, the door intercom buzzes. It's Takis Bennas, and he says, "Dictatorship, run, Chronis." Takis tells us that they have already arrested Ralis, Papandreou, and Kanellopoulos, and Takis goes into hiding too. Takis was the secretary of the youth. Chronis gathers whatever we had in our wallets and leaves. All we had was 200 drachma, really. So Chronis starts his life underground, practically skint. As for me, I thought, they've arrested political leaders. They're not interested in people at my level. They're interested in the top ones. And I'm trying to find a copy of the Constitution because I'm hearing on the radio what articles of the Constitution have been abolished to see which articles have been done away with. Naturally, I was quite upset. Because it's one thing to say, it will happen, it might happen, it's going to happen, and another to hear, it's happened, the tanks have come out. And not knowing, will the person who left be able to hide? Will those in Thessaloniki be able to hide? My brother, a builders' union leader, will he manage to hide? Where will he go? I froze, terrified. But I thought, now is our time. This is our judgment. Because until then, I stood modestly before the great leaders and those who had been tortured, and I thought, okay, this person knows. He or she has been tested. You haven't been tested. George Votsis, the journalist, passed by to see me. On his way out, the apartment door was next to the elevator door, and at that moment, we both had the same thought, that it might be the last time we see each other. We hugged and kissed. George left. I went back in, and shortly after, the doorbell rang again. It was Themis Banousis. He brought me his wife, Maria, a beautiful young woman from Crete. They had eloped and married because her family didn't approve of him. Themis left as well. And Maria and I were left together. Shortly after, the doorbell rings again, and the security police arrives. Katerina was sleeping on a cot that we had set up in our room. My mother was also with us. My mother, with a heavy heart, had lived through all this before. She had experienced it before and hoped that at least I would be spared. Everyone hoped so. That the difficult times had passed, and that we now lived in a democracy. They enter, furious. I don't even remember how many men there were. And they search the house. Where is your husband? I, the epitome of a law-abiding citizen. My husband is in Patras for the election campaign. We were preparing for elections, remember? I wanted to rub it in their faces that they were the ones operating outside the law, whereas we were well within our rights. Yes, I know. How naive I was. He says, but his shoes are here. Well, he doesn't only have one pair of shoes, I said. In the meantime, while they were searching, little Katerina woke up. You know how kids wake up with rosy cheeks? I saw the color drain from her face, because she understood what was happening. She knew. So while pretending to tidy things up, I emptied the contents of my bag onto the bed, mixing it in with the covers that they had already messed up, and I only took a few things, because I was afraid I might have something in my bag that I shouldn't. I put on my nice suit and left with the officers. At the 5th precinct, they took my information, and I saw my file. It was nice and thick. They sent me down to the holding cell, and there I found Avra Partsalidou, the Kiau couple, Vagelio Logara, and the father of Aleka Papariga. And I thought, if they count me among these leading figures, I'm in big trouble. Whenever I'm extremely anxious, I feel as if my brain isn't getting enough blood. I get dizzy and drowsy. I had leant my head on the shoulder of Aleka's father and was dozing, but I was listening. She's young and doesn't know what's coming, poor thing. That's why she's sleeping. And I thought to myself, it's precisely because I do know what's coming that I'm trying to escape by sleeping. From there, they took us in the afternoon and transferred us to the racetrack grounds. They were gathering people from different precincts at the racetrack. As we passed through Sint-Darma Square, all the streets were deserted. Deserted, deserted. People were terrified and kept indoors. In front of the monument of the unknown soldier, a woman, a tourist, had laid down, mimicking the pose of the unknown soldier. I was very disturbed by this image, and I thought, look at that. They take us to the racetrack. There, it crosses my mind. They might execute us. Because as we were getting off, I saw soldiers with bayonets fixed in two rows, one on either side of us. And I thought, they're going to execute us. They are leading us to execution. We had nothing. No blankets, no clothes, nothing, 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 nothing. I went with my little handbag, a very nice handbag, I'll have you know, yes, and a cinnamon-colored suit and a lace blouse that my mother had knitted for me. Why? In such situations, I want to present in a way that defies reality. That's why I went dressed as if for a happy occasion. And I remained in that happy occasion attire for 1.5 or 2 months in exile until the packages from home arrived. With a suit and the dainty little pumps and the nylon stockings, which had become threadbare. What runs? There were more holes and runs than there was stocking. Anyhow, at the racetrack, they put the women in one area and the men in another. Anna Solomou had her little child, Maki, with her. I kind of took charge of him while we were there, telling him stories and fairy tales and this and that. And we were singing Theodoraki songs inside the racetrack. However, we later realized that a terrible thing had happened next door where the men were held. They had beaten Iliou very badly and killed Panayotis Elis. He was the first victim of the dictatorship, Panayotis Elis. For no reason, for nothing. And after Elis's assassination, the Black Beret who killed him came in. If I were to say like a rabid dog, I'd have to apologize to the dogs. he walked among us as if he couldn't see us. If you happened to be in his path, he would trample you. We were frozen along the wall. He took a couple of furious rounds inside and then left. So we knew something horrific had happened. And shortly after, we learned that they had killed Panayotis. From the racetrack, they transferred us to Scaramangas. We boarded military ships and set off for some island. But we didn't know which island. Inside the ship's hold, we met with people who had been imprisoned and exiled before. Also new people who had never been exiled before. Upset, anxious, we were all anxious. We didn't know what awaited us. We didn't know where we were going. There were various guesses, but most said, Yaros. Indeed, we were taken to Yaros. And it was a sweet sight, a very sweet sight. It was a lovely April afternoon. Yaros was green with that small grass that sprouts even on the rocks in spring. I don't know how the others reacted, but a sense of peace came over me. And when the hatches opened, we saw the terraced levels that the previous exiles had shaped in order to pitch their tents. And in the middle, between the two bays, was the building, built of brick. We took the path uphill. Our first thought was, will they beat us now as we go down one by one? No beatings occurred, and the guard was barely visible. We learned that the first guard of Yaros was itself in an exile of sorts. They were former members of the Parliament's Guard who were rounded up and sent to the island because they were considered corrupt, having been in contact with the Parliament and MPs. To them, corruption was democracy. We landed on an uninhabited island, a prison that had been closed since 61. The door was ajar, wide open, and a long corridor, pitch dark, filthy, reeking of rodent and possibly human urine. Such filth. We were the first to enter. We were the first. Men and women. Of course, men and women were placed in separate wings. There were toilets, which, however, were not usable. They were filthy, and there was no water. None, not a drop. They had to bring it in with a water tanker. The conditions were miserable. The windows were broken. There were windows through which the rain came in, and it raised the issue of who would sleep beneath the window. Eventually, I said, fine, I will. We didn't have cots. Very few, extremely few, had cots. Our male fellow prisoners fabricated makeshift burlap mattresses stuffed with straw for us. I slept on the floor until my mother managed to send me a cot after 2 months, which served me throughout my captivity. At first, we didn't have meals. We ate dry food. At Easter, for example, we were fed canned food. They had transferred us on Holy Wednesday. On Easter Day of 67 in Yarosh, amidst the general gloom, two people appeared, a man and a woman, singing and dancing. Here atop the tender grass, what a tremendous dance will take place. And who do you think they were? Stefanos and I, Rinyo. In the dormitory, I was lucky because in the second berth next to mine was Vaso Katraki. Next to Vaso was Eleni Kamoulakou, and after me was Dora Psaltopoulou, an old Epon member who had been imprisoned with my sisters and now got the chance to meet the youngest Papatsarouha. There was no privacy. Most people didn't have clothes with them. I had a shirt that my mother gave me. Well, that shirt was worn by whoever could fit into it while they washed their own, so it was everyone's stand-in top. The dictator Patakos came to Yaros. He came to our dormitory. And there, Eleni Faliaga, a teacher, confronted him about our rights and so on, and Patakos couldn't get a word in edgewise. And as he left, he made this hand gesture, as if to say they should cut their tongues out with scissors. And he left, certain that we needed to be exterminated. More and more people kept arriving. At some point, there must have been around 6,000 of us. We couldn't all fit. They set up tents. They set up tents in both bays, on the fourth and the fifth cove too, on the left and the right of the prison. There was also an attempt at a semblance of organization, of networking. I participated in the mechanism for spreading news. When we were taken out for a walk, someone might have had a contact, and so, from person to person, the news bulletin passed. They told me that I should head the youth faction, representing the young women. And I said, elections. Because the girls might not want me. They might want somebody else. They said, elections under such conditions aren't possible. Well then, I won't take charge, I said. During that summer, three or four times, they called me down to the administration office, always the same young man who introduced himself with a name that varied in ending, but always started with Anastas. Anastasiadis, Anastasakos, Anastasakis, a different name each time. He pretended to be my friend, telling me things like, so-and-so made a statement, so-and-so signed a disclaimer, and sign a statement so you can leave. I will do no such thing. Once, twice, three times, the last time he calls me into his office, where his bed was, unmade. Sit down, he says. I said, I don't see a chair. It's okay, he says, sit on the bed. I was really frightened. Where would I sit? A 27, 28-year-old Rinyo. Where would I sit? No, I said, it's okay. We don't have much to say anyway. We've covered everything. What do you want from me? Make a statement. Why should I make a statement and what should I renounce? The Communist Party. I said, I told you already. I won't make a statement because I have nothing to renounce. I'm not a communist. Since you're not a communist, he said, why don't you renounce it? Because I wouldn't renounce even Buddhism, any ism. I wouldn't renounce anything under dictation, I said, not even the daisy I wear on my lapel. But that time, I was terrified because I saw the unmade bed and the tone of his voice when he said, sit down. Yeah, you get the picture. The administration office was down by the sea, quite a long distance from the prisons and the women's dormitories. Even if you were to scream, who would hear you? Who would hear you? So I said, tell me, if I admit that I'm a communist, will you stop calling me? He said, yes. Well then, I am. And indeed, they stopped calling me. But it was the only time I declared myself a communist. And that was the end of that. There was no torture, but there were many other deprivations. For example, they could deprive you of correspondence. They deprived me of it for 2 months, and I didn't know what was happening in the world. At some point, a letter came through announcing my father's death in Poland and the death of my sister's newborn. 2 months without a letter, and when this one came, they gave it to me, with the two deaths. Because my father had left as a guerrilla. After the defeat, the guerrillas escaped to the various people's republics. He died alone, in Zgorzelets, and a few comrades found him when he didn't show up for 2 or 3 days. They went and found him, dead, at home. I collapsed. I broke down. I had a nervous breakdown. I stayed in bed for 3 days, unable to get up, dizzy, unable to eat anything, and vomiting uncontrollably. And then I learned to make a makeshift saline solution. In a bottle of water, lemon juice, sugar, and salt, just enough so that no taste overpowers the others, because I was at risk of dehydration. These were the kinds of torture in Jarosz. The other thing is the concern you have when leaving your family behind. My mother lost 10 kilos in 15 days. There were families deprived of their sole financial support, whether it was the father or the son. There were children left without their parents, like the young son of Urania Nizamidu. Both Urania and her husband were in Jarosz. Their older son, Yanis, was a soldier, and the little child was left alone in Janica. The neighbors gave him food, but none dared take him into their home. The child slept under the stairs. So you think, okay, I am defending my ideas and my dignity, but do I have the right to place such a burden on my children, my mother, my wife? Do I have the right? Don't they have their own dignity to defend? Just so that you can be the hero, at peace with yourself. And when you have a conscience, this is very tough, extremely tough, especially for the mothers who had left children behind. I saw mothers crying at night, filled with anxiety and guilt, but secretly so it wouldn't show. I remember Urania Nizamidu walking around until late. I was outside too. I stayed to listen to the news. Urania couldn't sleep because she was thinking about her child outside. I never gave up reading. Never. Never. In Jarosz, I slept with Elitis under my pillow. Once when a fellow inmate asked me, what is this book you read every day? Lend it to me. I watched her, and as soon as she fell asleep, I quietly took it from under her pillow so I wouldn't be deprived. Reading, you see, is a great relief. And reading always comforted me. In the afternoon, I took off my little suit, shook it well after the shift was over, the carrying, the wheelbarrow, the rubble, all of that, and I brushed my hair, shook up my clothes, put on my threadbare stockings, and stuck a daisy on my lapel, and went for a walk. We were allowed to go for a walk. I dressed up, defending beauty both inwardly and outwardly, because beauty is a duty, and beauty is a blessing. Beauty will save the world. That's what I have always believed. On August 28, 1968, we were transferred from Yaros to Crete, to Heraklion, to the suburb of Alikarnassos. There were prisons there. The men left in two groups and were taken to Leros, to Parthenni, and Laki, and then us women were sent to Alikarnassos. We were preventively detained, but lived in prison conditions. Preventively detained for so many years is inconceivable under democratic legislation. For the junta, everything was taken for granted, including cold-blooded murders. Indeed, conditions were better in an inhabited area. We were not isolated. We could shout if something happened, and people would hear us. Only this once, very close to the Alikarnassos prison, there was a football field and there was a match being played. We thought, now's our chance. We gathered at the window, large windows, glass panes in the stairwell, all of us there so that people would see us and understand that there were prisoners here. The men of Crete saw us and started making gestures. Yes, and here we were, thinking that the democratic people of Crete would be moved by our presence. What a lark. The democratic people made other kinds of gestures, not gestures of support, if you get my drift. Many men left after signing declarations, a great many. For women, signing a declaration was very rare. At the end of August 1970, Chronis had a dream. There was a shipwreck, I was on the ship, and only 21 women were saved. Chronis thought, I hope Marina managed to survive because I taught her well how to swim. And he kept thinking that to himself after he awoke. There was a rumor circulating that an amnesty would be granted. The list of women arrived, and they started reading it out. They said, 21 women are being released. And they read, and read, and read, and read, and my blood froze, because it went 18, 19, 20. The last three were three classicists, Eleni Garidi, Irini Tsakiri, and Irini Papatsaroucha. 21st. And Irini Papatsaroucha. Chronis' dream, right? That he had taught his girl to swim well and hoped she survived. I was the 21st. But up until the 21st name was heard, I nearly went mad. This term of nearly 3.5 years helped me build the courage to defend my views, whatever the cost. Let me tell you, my dear, in hardships, in deprivations, you discover abilities, strengths, and traits that life doesn't otherwise give you the opportunity to discover. Some people wither away. Some people are merely loyal to the political line. Fortunately for me, my participation was a matter of conscience since my youngest age, a matter of personal importance. And that's what kept me going. This conscience. This conscience is the little vessel, the walnut shell that helps you stay afloat and endure all the turmoil. And for me, it was a personal matter. Democracy is my personal matter. And it should be the personal matter of all citizens. I came out on top, just so.
Historima. Listen to the Extraordinary. A collaboration between ERT Eco and Historima.org. Historima is supported by a founding grant from the Stavros Niarchos Foundation.